Choke Points, brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. A question for all motorcyclists today is, do you want to make it home alive? And Chris is going to explain why we're asking that question.
Because I almost killed somebody on Sunday.
Yikes.
It was a blink of an eye away from hitting a motorcycle while I was traveling 75 miles an hour on the northbound I-5 corridor in Tacoma, dumping that rider on the pavement, leaving her for the convoy of other drivers also going 75 who were right behind me. Did I fail to look? Was I distracted? No, to both of those. The rider was lane splitting between me and the car next to me that I was passing and also going 75 miles an hour. If I had not noticed her lane splitting in my rearview mirror for a moment, just brief moment earlier, it would have been all over for her. When I passed the car and moved into the HOV lane on my left with my blinker on, she was on my hip and completely hidden as I looked. Couldn't see her anywhere. I felt her there because I'd seen her in my rearview mirror, so I hesitated. Her handlebar nearly scraped my door.
Yikes.
Why am I sharing this story? Because it scared the hell out of me. And I want all motorcycle riders to make it home. That and plenty of listeners are texting me lately that they see lane splitting all the time now for motorcycles. Let me make it plain and simple. Lane splitting is illegal in Washington. It always has been. The legislature raised the idea a couple times in the last decade, but nothing was ever passed. Washington State Trooper Rick Johnson says a lot of riders, when pulled over for this, argued that the law has changed. It hasn't.
And I think people talk to other people, like the telephone game. Hey, this passed. Well, no, like we were talking, it passed out of the Senate, but it died in the House. It's not a law.
It only passed out of one Senate committee. Never even made it to the whole Senate. Never even made it across chambers. Lane splitting is illegal. I'll say that again. Trooper Johnson says that it's only legal in California. And our drivers don't expect it. They aren't prepared for it. And they will not look an extra time to see if you're there.
This area is not used to lane splitting. And it's probably one of the reasons why it hasn't passed, is because if that were to pass, I feel, after doing this for 31 years, that we would have a lot more collisions.
Trooper Johnson says most of the reports come in congestion, when the cars aren't moving and the motorcycles can kind of slide between the lanes or on the shoulders to bypass the backups. My experience with a rider splitting at speed might be an outlier. I don't know. I've seen other drivers or other riders do this, and our drivers have also texted to me that they have seen this splitting at speed as well. I asked Trooper Johnson what I could have done differently, if anything, and he told me I was lucky that I had seen that rider for that brief moment.
You're triple checking, you're looking, and the last thing you expect is a motorcycle to be splitting lanes, especially at that speed. Really, I mean, what do you do? I mean, if they're sitting in a blind spot and also in a place where they shouldn't be as far as in between the lanes, you know, you got lucky. The motorcycle rider got lucky, really.
And what really surprised me in all of this was the rider never even acknowledged that I was there. As she passed me, bike to door mirror, I honked, got no reaction. She just moved on to the next group of cars that were in her way and kept splitting between them. Still pretty shaken up by this, actually. You could probably tell that a little bit. Yeah. Because I'm thinking of those milliseconds where both of our lives would have been changed forever if either one of us had done something differently.
I'm curious, would a blind spot detector on cars that have them detect a motorcycle?
That I don't know. I'm assuming that they do. But again, I don't have that technology on my car. It just happened to have... But I mean, where she was on my back quarter panel by my back tire... and that's where she was going and kind of matching my speed. So, yeah, I mean, I felt her, right? It was one of those instinctual things. And thank God I did, because if I'd have gone without a care, she'd have been down. And what would have happened after would have been horrific for all of us.
Well, I haven't had a close call like that, but I've certainly had plenty of close calls, and I just have to do the swivel head thing, you know, which takes your eyes off what's in front of you.
That is true.
You know, when you're doing that, but it is true. And my car doesn't have that blind spot detection technology. That's going to have to be standard, I think, the way people are driving these days.
Yeah, and again, I'm not out here to bash motorcyclists, right? That's not my goal. I almost killed one of you. And I want everybody who's riding to get home safely, right? So I'm not. Don't take this as a bash on motorcyclists, because it's not. It's just that something's got to be done, because my troopers are seeing it more often. My texters are telling me about it more often. And it just happened to me. So it's happening. And I want everybody to get home safely. And it's just, I mean, this run, this kind of messed me up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you can communicate with us using the text line at 888-973-KIRO and just tell us what you think, especially if you ride a motorcycle.
Very smart, that code word. Brought to you by Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. Visit BairdSeattle.com. This is your daily dose of kindness. Sometimes the best ideas come just by observing the world around you. James Warren was on a walk in his Denver neighborhood when he was struck by a sight.
A woman was waiting for the bus, sitting in the dirt. And I was like, oh man, that sucks. You know, that's not dignified at all. We need to be doing better by our, fellow city members. And so I thought I could do something about that. I could build a bench.
He was already handy with his power tools, so he got to work making a simple bench for that bus stop. He used scrap wood found at a construction site, and then he kept building, which inspired others.
What's been really cool is seeing other people online building their own benches, or even just taking chairs that they were going to throw out or maybe found that somebody else was throwing out and putting them by bus stops instead of letting them go to landfill.
Since he first noticed a lack of seating at bus stops, he's built 8 benches, each one with a special message written on it. Be kind.
Sometimes it's difficult to really make a change in the world around us, or it can feel really difficult to make a change in the world around us. But the truth is that anyone can be kind. And by being kind, you can make a difference in the world around you. And that difference matters a lot. And so just maybe a little reminder to people.
It's now a movement, people tagging him on social media when they build a bench and place it at a bus stop.
I saw these posts like on Twitter, and they said, I was inspired by you to build a bench. I was inspired by you to put out a chair. And that in turn inspires me, because it's cool. It's no longer just like one dude doing something for his neighborhood. It's dudes and dudettes all over the community doing things for their neighborhoods. So it's really inspiring to see that.
And he hopes it continues. You can be one of those dudes or dudettes building a bench.
Yep. It's always good to find another reason to use your power tools. That's what I like about building things. 7:48, and here he is from the GNRS show, which takes over the studio at 9 o'clock. G. Scott. So you've probably seen this video going around about with Richard Sherman and K.J. Wright, former Seahawks. They're talking about Russell Wilson, so let's play a clip. Watch your monitors.
Well, he was young. It was like, well, he was a year younger than us. Like, he ain't that young. When you got 52 guys being held to a certain standard, you got one guy not being held to the standard, then it's going to cause some friction. After a while, it had to get to the point where he chose Russ or the defense. And after the Super Bowl loss, he kind of made it pretty clear who he was choosing.
So it sounds like they're saying that while he was with the Seahawks, Russell Wilson got special treatment.
I'm sure he did. He's quarterback. I'm sure that Richard Sherman got special treatment at some point, too. We all love our kids, but do we treat them the same? No, we don't. Do we try to treat them fair? Yes, we do. And in this case, you know, I think that teams or the Seahawks or Pete Carroll, whoever, try to do the best that they can. In the case of Russell Wilson, you're hearing now all of these takes about the accountability, and you hear Richard Sherman say right there that, you know, that the whole team had to be held accountable, but he wasn't held accountable at the same standards as they were. And I'm not going to dispute that. Maybe that is true. But sometimes you make these concessions for the betterment of the team. If there's one thing that I've learned in corporate America, don't expect for everything to be fair. Sometimes you go to work and everybody doesn't have the same standards as you. That's just up to the bosses, right? And I'm going to say the same thing here. So what you're hearing me say, and I want to be very clear, I believe what they say is true. I also believe that each one of them had their own special treatment at some point as well. Hold on. As a matter of fact, I know for a fact Marshawn Lynch had his own set of rules. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. So what you're saying is you don't care for this pettiness coming from Richard Sherman, especially. Like, I love inside Seahawks drama. I mostly follow them on Instagram for their personal lives, not their sports. And so this has really been intriguing to me, especially when I think Richard Sherman, he retweeted a video clip of Russell Wilson, like a failed play with just the emoji of a chef, which I meant to take, you know, let Russ cook. Well, apparently he's still cooking. Yeah. You don't approve of this kind of talk?
I love petty. I want to be clear. I want to be clear. I love petty. I love subtle petty. I think that Richard Sherman I'll tell him this too. I think that sometimes you got to leave a little bit out there for people to wonder, right? Don't say it all.
Yeah,
now we
know how he feels about it.
Right? Now we know. Like you did a podcast about it and you're saying it. And so now all of the fans are, maybe it is true.
Sometimes he becomes the anti-hero too, which you hate to see from such a football legend.
Yeah, agreed, Colleen. Sometimes you just got to let it just simmer out there. You just got to be cool. And which is tough to do, I have to admit. But, you know, sometimes pettiness is better subtle, Dave Ross.
We have a clip here from KJ Wright, who joins Brock and Salk every Wednesday on Salesports 710. So here's a clip from yesterday's show. I haven't heard this yet.
You got to just be one with the people. I always say this. You got to be one with the people, right? Just be cool. Be easygoing. I saw him screaming the other day, run past, and like belligerent. Like, bro, this isn't Pop Warner football. What are we doing here? This isn't Pop Warner high school JV football. I could tell if it's a run or a pass.
He's talking about Russell Wilson was on the sideline, and what happens is in football, it is good for the, you know, usually in junior football, high school football, you let the defense know if it's a run or a pass. So, for an example, if the quarterback drops back and you see the quarterback is looking to pass, everybody on the sideline screams, pass. So, you know, that's just what you do. But, yo, it's the pros now. You can't be telling grown men that get paychecks and got family and kids to say run or pass. You can't be talking to them like that. And that's what KJ is saying. Again, Colleen, this is going to be something where, bless Russell's heart, everything he does now is going to be scrutinized. And as a matter of fact, this game they play against the San Francisco 49ers this weekend. The San Francisco 49ers, which I was trying to allude to last week, are good.
Yeah.
They are a good football team. Well, Colleen, I think they're going to lose that game. And the Denver Broncos are probably going to go down to 1-2. And it's just going to be a disaster.
I'll say this. He opened himself up to scrutiny when he endorsed Eat the Ball.
Oh, you see that petty right there?
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm petty.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock with Ursula. Thank you, G. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And joining us is physicist Sean Carroll, who is going to explain space-time and calculus and derivatives and integrals.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll save that for your lecture. But what I want to bring up, and this is about your latest book, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, Space, Time, and Motion. The thing I was not prepared for in this was your chapter on presentism, eternalism, and possibilism. Mm. So before we even start, is there a way to explain this on the radio that will allow people to continue their commute to work normally without driving off the road and still get something out of it?
Well, look, if a few people drive off the road, that's just the risk that we have to take to understand the biggest ideas in the universe. But yeah, I think that presentism, possibilism, eternalism are different ways of thinking about the nature of time. And this is part of what I try to do in the book. You know, I talk mostly about physics and there's lots of equations in the book, but I'm interested in digging into the philosophical underpinnings of it as well. And so if you were an ancient thinker, if you were Aristotle, if you were living 2,500 years ago, if you said, you know, what is the world? you might say, well, it's a bunch of objects. You know, I have in front of me a table and a chair and whatever, and they're arranged in space. Here's space around me and different things have locations. Mm-hmm. And if someone says, what about time? They'll say, well, oh, but the universe is space and all the stuff in it, and it just keeps happening over and over again, and we call that time. But modern physics suggests that that division into space and time isn't quite absolute. It's as if the whole four-dimensional thing, every point in space at every moment of time, is equally real. But not everyone agrees. So that equally real perspective is called eternalism. The whole universe, all of eternity, is all real, past, present, and future. A presentist says that only now is real. Okay. Neither the past or the future are real. The possibilist says that now and the past are real because the past is set, right? It's in the books. It's nothing happened. We can do about it, but the future is still up for grabs.
Hmm. And how do you define real in this sense?
Oh, I don't. That's the beauty of it.
Okay. Well, that
you know
makes
it when
sense.
You see it. People will, of course, debate endlessly over what you mean by real, mm-hmm. but that is not a philosophical discussion that I get into in this book.
The reason that I think people find this interesting is because we cling to this idea that there can be such a thing as time travel. And I just don't see how that we could actually go back to the past and insert ourselves in some past event, or that we could travel into the future and then come back to the present, remembering what we saw in the future. So once and for all, can you tell us if any of that would ever be possible?
No, it won't be possible. Don't worry about it.
Good.
You know, in this book, I very clearly focus on the parts of physics and nature that we do understand. So I don't get very speculative about extra dimensions or multiverses or time travel or things like that. In other books, I have written about them. I wrote a book called From Eternity to Here, which is about the nature of time. And I talk about time travel, and it's interesting because I don't think it's possible. That's why I said no. I think there's very good reasons to expect it will never happen. But we can't prove it. Our knowledge of the laws of physics is not quite good enough to let us be definitive. Like, we can say you can't travel faster than the speed of light, and that's pretty settled. That's pretty much something you should be confident in. But the not going backward in time, I'm pretty sure it's right, but I can't make you an absolute promise.
Black holes have become a big focus, you know, especially since we got those new images from the Webb telescope and people talking about all the possibilities out there. Can you describe black holes in a way that most can understand them and what we currently know about them?
Yeah, black holes have gone from something that nobody believed in mm-hmm. to something that people thought were interesting but very speculative to now they're all over the place. And a black hole is just a region of space where matter has been squeezed into such a small region that gravity has become really, really strong. And gravity has become so strong that nothing can escape the gravitational field in this region of space, not even light. You know, there's a limit in relativity. You can't go faster than the speed of light. To escape a black hole, you would have to go faster than the speed of light. And this is an implication of Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity, but it was not one that he invented or even knew about. We sort of came to terms with it in the 50s and 60s, and now we take pictures. There's a giant black hole, 4 million times the mass of the sun, right at the center of our Milky Way galaxy.
Well, I mean, black holes are interesting because of the intense gravity, and gravity appears to be the key to everything, and yet nobody really understands how it works, right? I mean, do we understand? It's not like magnetism. We don't understand how it works.
No, we do. We do. We understand gravity pretty well. We understood gravity well enough to get a rocket to the moon ever since Isaac Newton's time. You know, Newton himself didn't know about rockets, but there's a famous quote from the Apollo astronauts as they were in between the Earth and the moon when they said, Sir Isaac Newton has taken the controls now. And we understood gravity even better once Albert Einstein came along in the early 20th century and pointed out that gravity can be thought of as the curvature of space-time itself. And that idea has been incredibly successful. People have tried to disprove it. People have tried to mm-hmm. not disprove the curvature of space-time idea, but the specific equations that Einstein suggested that govern how space and time bend under the force of gravity. Even I have come up with alternatives to Einstein's ideas, but no one has been able to out-Einstein. So his version of how gravity works has been proven extremely successful.
But the idea that the gravity bends like the very world around us. That's what you're talking about, right? It just bends everything. Implies that there's something connecting everything, doesn't it? I mean, we don't have an ether anymore. We don't believe in the ether anymore. But there's something there connecting everything together and allowing us to be grabbed by gravity. So what is that
thing?
There's
space-time.
That's what that is.
That's what it is. It is space-time. This is part of, you know, this is not something that we just sort of suggested because it sounded cool. These are all ideas that we are dragged into suggesting, kicking and screaming, because we're trying to fit the data and the experiments in a way that is logically consistent. And eventually people came up with this idea that space-time itself should be thought of as a substance. It has a life of its own. And Einstein gave us an equation for exactly what space-time does under different circumstances. And we test that equation to exquisite precision. And so far, it's come through with flying colors.
Sean Carroll, the author of The Biggest Ideas in the Universe. Sean, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me. You can ring my bell. Ring your
bell. Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here's Rachel Bell with a new edition of her podcast, Your Last Meal, featuring Jack Johnson, singer-songwriter. You can meet the moonlight in a night you really want.
It's waiting in your own backyard. That is Jack Johnson's new song called Meet the Moonlight. That is his eighth studio album. And I was so excited to do this interview because I actually interviewed him 20 years ago this year. I was still a senior in college. I was writing for an alt weekly as a music writer. And this was the beginning of his career too. So it was my first cover story at this paper and I saved it. So when I spoke to him, I pulled up the paper. We were on Zoom and he was on the cover and I told him the story and that I was living in Chico, California, Northern California. And he surprised me by saying this.
Wait, you weren't the one that called me Jerk Johnson, were you?
No. You will have to listen to this episode of Your Last Meal to hear the whole story. But what he said was, you didn't call me Jerk Johnson, did you? And apparently someone around that time did, and he thought it was me. And no, I would never call someone I was interviewing a jerk.
Of course not.
Anyway, Jack is an amazing person. He is an environmentalist. He was born and raised, still lives in Hawaii. He's been a surfer his whole life, very concerned about plastics in the ocean, especially. So when he goes on tour, he's done this for at least a decade. He tries to get venues to go completely plastic free, no water bottles or anything.
We try to have reusable pint cup programs where we can. And venue wide, everybody was given a pint cup as they came in. Refill of water stations all around the venue. And then if you got cocktails or beer or anything at the bars, it was all a refill program. We've been doing it backstage for, I mean, almost since we began, but out in the front of the house. Yeah, the last 10 years, it's been a nice evolution of eliminating the single use. We can't always ban the single use plastic sales, but we try our best.
So they learned some things from Willie Nelson and Neil Young, the way they tour. They've gone all biodiesel. He gives his entire touring crew reusable utensils and mugs and cups. So the whole thing is no plastic the whole tour, which I think is awesome. If you listen to Jack Johnson, you probably know his song, Banana Pancakes. Your Last Meal is a show about food. So we always talk about food. So I had to ask him a bit about the story behind that song.
So my wife and I have been together 29 years. And so I guess when I wrote that song, we were probably late 20s or something. We were living together and we had our first kid around then. I'd actually stayed up all night writing this other song that was more like a deep cut on that same album called No Other Way. I played her No Other Way and I was trying to get her attention. She was doing something and, you know, you feel like you've just written this really nice thing. And then, like, I don't mean to make her sound bad because the poor thing has to hear my songs every time I got a new idea and they're not all good. And so anyway, I played her a song and she didn't really even turn around. And then I was thinking, like, I guess not that good. And then I got kind of frustrated. I was like, you hardly even notice when I try to show you this song is meant to keep you from doing what you're supposed to. It was just that first line. And then she turned around and she was like, oh, but that's a good one. And I was like, ah, shoot. Okay. That gave me the spark for that song. But baby, you hardly even notice when I try to show you song is meant to keep you doing what you're supposed to. Waking up too early, maybe we could sleep.
Make you banana pancakes, pretend like I made banana pancakes last weekend because of editing this
Did you really?
This show, yes. So since he talks a lot about environmentalism, I contacted this woman I follow on Instagram. Her name's Anne Marie Bonneau. She calls herself the Zero Waste Chef. And I try to be as zero waste as I can. I'm probably at like 30%. I'm not at 100%. But this woman goes through drastic measures to not use any kind of plastic, which means she doesn't buy a lot of snacks. She makes everything herself, including her own dried fruit.
It was so hot. And I had some tomatoes, and I thought, I'm going to try dehydrating them in the car. So I took a cookie sheet, and I put a cooling rack inside the cookie sheet. And then I just spread my tomatoes across that and put it in the rear windshield of the car, and they dehydrated. It worked really well. The neighbors must have wondered, what is she doing carrying those trays of nuts up to the car?
I'm sure they already know you're a little nuts. They see all your experiments.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Are you basically at this point 100% plastic free?
Not 100%. I buy milk and cream in returnable glass bottles, and those have a little plastic ring on them. My kids are grown, so I'm not responsible for anything they bring into our home. My daughter and I, she was 13. We had a little spat over something, and she stormed out. And when she came home, she had a bottle of water. She just looked at me when she walked in the door.
That was her big rebellion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was intentional.
You can listen to the whole episode. There is so much more with Jack Johnson and Anne Marie Bonneau. Go to yourlastmealpodcast.com. You can go anywhere you get podcasts, or you can text the word Jack to our text line, which you might have to help me out here, Dave. 1-888-973-KIRO. KIRO.
Yeah. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.